Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Sir John Daniel, President and Chief Executive Officer, Commonwealth of Learning. Sir John, you bring to this interview a substantial history of significant and considerable national and international contribution. We are indeed very, very fortunate to have you come in today to do this interview with us and to share your many deep and rich experiences with the audience. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
John, you were participating at the World Computer Congress due to your globally recognized leadership. Can you tell our audience, I should say, more about your work and your experiences at the WCC?
Yes, I went to the WCC at their invitation and presented a paper which I think was called Computers in the Classroom, A Busted Flush. And the thesis which I put across was that so far the use of computers in the classroom had been pretty much of a disappointment, which is quite important because, after all, politicians and many countries are sort of falling over themselves to put computers into the classroom. So I suggested that so far we were very far from having any kind of serious value out of all this big investment. I think I was somewhat disappointed at the reaction, because essentially everyone seemed to agree with me. But it was because I think the audience there were largely computer people. I mean, this is a computer conference, so that's not surprising. So I was perhaps disappointed there weren't more people who had an educational spin on computers. And, I mean, if I may make a gratuitous remark, I think the WCC probably needs to think its formula a bit more, because I got the impression it was too broadly based. There were too many parallel things going on and too many different aspects of computing being discussed. I was struck by the fact that although there were meant to be hundreds of people there, the largest plenary I was in only had a few hundred. So I got the impression really that the focus is now moving more from the WCC conference to the IFIP conference, which has a more development nation focus, and is I think emerging as a very important conference.
Well, that's really very interesting in terms of your insights, and I'm sure we will be watching what happens in the future. Now, John, can you profile your experiences and lessons from serving for 3 years as Assistant Director General for Education at UNESCO?
Yes, well, that was a most interesting move, because it was previous to that I'd spent most of my career in universities, and particularly universities teaching at a distance. And this was a move to a big intergovernmental organization. And, I mean, there were lots and lots of things that were different about it. First of all, instead of having a responsibility within higher education only as Assistant Director General for Education, I was basically responsible to the world for advice on education from womb to tomb, if you like, the whole thing from early childhood right through, because UNESCO has a very broad mandate in education. So that was interesting. The big issue while I was there was the campaign for Education for All, which had been launched in the year 2000 at the Dakar Forum, and there were six goals broadly covering most aspects of education. However, in the Millennium Development Goals in the same year, they picked out universal primary education and gender equality as the two key goals. And a lot of the effort of the international community during my time at UNESCO was focused on those, although UNESCO tried to keep a slightly broader focus. But we were working very closely with the World Bank and with UNICEF, and inevitably, since the money was being funneled towards universal primary, that was where a lot of the effort went. Working in an intergovernmental organization was very different from working in a university. In a university, broadly speaking, your board is supportive of the university, and even when governments appoint people who are a bit hostile to the university, a sensible university president can turn those people within a few months to be fairly rabid supporters of the university. But in an intergovernmental organization, your board members are simply representing their countries. So they're watching their country's back. They're putting their country's policies forward. So it's much more difficult to get any kind of consensus. So you feel it's a quite different relationship, really, between the staff and the board. But UNESCO is interesting because it is perhaps the most democratic of the UN bodies. It really is a kind of one country, one vote, in a way that the UN itself and certainly the World Bank is not. In the World Bank, you essentially vote by money. And in the UN, of course, there's a Security Council. So not everyone is created equal. But in UNESCO, it's a more equal sort of setup. And for that reason, the developing countries regard it very much as their thing. So you can get things done through UNESCO that you couldn't get done through the World Bank or through other bodies. So it was very interesting in that respect. And it certainly has great convening power. When you convene a meeting on something, countries will tend to send people. So although I'm sure UNESCO frustrates some of the developed countries, it is a forum that that they remain active in. So for me, it was a wonderful introduction to the whole international community, intergovernmental relations, and a wonderful training for coming to a smaller and more focused intergovernmental body, the Commonwealth of Learning, where I am now.
You know, I'm sort of curious then, what sort of steps led you to become Assistant Director General? Like, how did you get involved to get into that position?
Well, that was very simple. I mean, I'd been at the Open University for 11 years by then, and one day I got a call from the head of the British Department for International Development, the senior civil servant in that department, who said, John, have you seen this ad in The Economist? And I said, no, what are you talking about? So he said, well, Britain has just rejoined UNESCO, and there's an important job, senior job, and we'd like to have a Brit in there if we can. So, you know, we'd be interested in having you apply. We won't support you, you know, overtly. We won't even tell UNESCO you're applying, but you know, why don't you have a go? So anyway, he brought the British ambassador to UNESCO over from Paris for a lunch, which happened to be on the 4th of July, I remember, because he was wearing a rather sort of gorgeous Stars and Stripes tie. Anyway, we had a lunch together, and I decided to give it a whirl, and got the job. So so that was an interesting move, and very timely, because it was time. I'm a believer that if you can't do something in 10 years, you never will. And I'd been at the Open University for 11 years by that time, so a move was timely. And I'd always been very internationally oriented, so it seemed like an interesting opportunity. One interesting sidelight on that was that when I got the job, the Brits said, right, well, we will treat you just like any other international civil servant. You know, we won't have any special communication with you. And indeed, when you join an organization like that, you have to swear an oath that you will not take instructions from any government. So I arrived feeling that this was the normal thing. And it took me a while to realize that a lot of my colleagues were sort of going for coffee several times a week with their own national delegations to UNESCO, and that this oath, if you like, was, shall we say, semi-respected at best. But I strongly believed in the British attitude that if you're an international civil servant, you're working for the international community, and you forget your own nationality for that period.
You know, that's very fascinating. And, you know, you did mention Open University in the UK, so that's a sort of a natural segue. Can you tell us about your experiences in the summer 1972 at the brand new UK Open University?
Yes, well, the context was that I'd arrived in 1969 in my first teaching job at the University of Montreal, teaching metallurgical engineering. And after a few months, I had what I later discovered was a rather perverse reflex that since I was a university teacher, I should learn something about education, the scientific study thereof. So I looked around to see what I could do part-time, because it had to be part-time, that was reasonably sort of intellectually serious. And the only program I could see that I could do was a master's in educational technology at what was then called Sir George Williams University, which was another university in Montreal. Anyway, I signed up for what was a 2-year full-time program, which I was doing part-time, which had coursework, obviously, plus a thesis, plus an internship. And so I decided I'd get the internship over fairly quickly. So I looked around to see where I could go for 3 months in an organization that was using educational technology. And at that time, we're talking 1971 now, the papers were full of stories about this amazing project by the Brits of all people called the Open University, which is using technology on a large scale to kind of transform university education. So I thought, this sounds interesting. Wrote off to them and said, you know, I'd be interested in doing my internship. And they replied and said, well, you know, do come. We won't pay you, but we'll give you a desk and some work. So University of Montreal generously gave me the summer to do that. So off I went. And it was a revelation. It was absolutely a conversion on the road to Milton Keynes, which is where the Open University is. It was in its second year of operation by then, already had 40,000 students. I was given the task of, well, I was given a number of tasks, working on the revision team for the foundation course in technology, which was in its first year, and they had a team that was watching the offering of that course in order to make some corrections and revisions for the second year. But I was on another course team, and I went around the country a bit visiting Open University events, and it was just an amazing experience. First of all, the scale. Secondly, the use of technology. I spent most of my spare moments watching the BBC radio and television programs and really familiarizing myself with the system. I went off to one of their summer schools where I was staggered by the student focus, the idealism, and the terrific energy and keenness of the students themselves, who seemed to spend all day from 9 a.m. till 6 p.m. doing the program, and then from 6 p.m. to midnight in the bar, and often beyond midnight, but not in the bar just talking football, but in the bar talking about the courses they were doing. So it was an enormously stimulating period, and I thought, well, I've seen the future of higher education, and I want to be part of it. So when I came back to Canada, I was very lucky. I managed to get a new job with the then new Open University in Quebec called the Téléuniversité, and my career took off in a different direction.
So can you then tell us more about your time at this UK Open University? For example, can you outline your past roles and key lessons that you wish to share from each of your prior roles?
Well, I was only there for 3 months. This was an internship. So as I say, I was part of a very junior member. The Open University develops courses in teams, and I was a very junior member of, I think it was a third level course in science called Solids, Liquids and Gases, which later was considered one of the few real dogs that the Open University produced. I mean, a course that students really didn't find very congenial. But it was very interesting to see the course team at work. I think they've slimmed it down a bit now, but in those days you'd have quite a number of academics, even on a third level course, and a BBC producer, an editor, an instructional designer. I mean, you had a whole team of people who worked together to produce these courses, which is why they were of such immensely high quality. The big foundation courses, like the course in technology that I was working on the revision of, I mean, the course team for that would probably be somewhere in the region of 25 people. So a huge investment was made in developing those courses, the written materials, the TV, the radio, the home experiment kits, the summer school program, the whole tutorial support system. And that was why the Open University established a terrific reputation for quality really right out of the starting gate. So seeing that, and the sort of student focus of it, the fact that the whole thing was directed to allowing students who had very varied educational backgrounds to succeed in a university course which was not dumbed down in any way. I mean, what they'd done was to turn the traditional British system on its head. I went to Oxford, which was hard to get into, but once you got into, it was pretty easy to get out of with some kind of a degree. The Open University is exactly the other way around. There were no academic requirements for admission, so it was easy to get into, but then you were examined on every course, and therefore you had to keep up a high level of performance in order to get a degree. And, you know, I think this is actually a much more sensible approach, and is of course the approach that is more and more adopted these days. So seeing all that, having gone through a relatively traditional education myself, was a revelation and changed my whole outlook to university education.
That really inspired you to continue on, right? Because you then, after that experience, went on to the Tele University in Quebec, and you became vice president of Athabasca, vice rector of Concordia, and then back to the UK as vice chancellor of the Open University. Can you tell us more about those experiences and maybe some lessons from those roles?
Yes, well, the Tele University was fascinating. I moved up to Quebec City in 1973. This, of course, was an entirely French operation. And, I mean, as well as being professionally interesting, it was personally very interesting because this was the sort of high point, the development of the separatist movement in Quebec. And the Tele University was a magnet for nationalist Quebec intellectuals who wanted essentially to sort of rewrite the intellectual framework of Quebec in a way that they found congenial. In other words, rewrite the economics, the history from a nationalist perspective. So they were a tremendously interesting bunch of people. My task was to create a little educational technology instructional design unit. And I was, for the first year, I was on my own. So in wondering, well, how do I do that? I zeroed in on the idea that I would evaluate, I would get student feedback on the courses and simply feed that back to the faculty who were producing the courses. And I think that was a pretty good strategy because in the end of the day, feedback is important. It didn't make me popular because those were the days when university teachers still actually didn't like being told that their stuff wasn't brilliant. But it did, I think, have an effect of making the Tele University a self-improving system. So I think that was the main lesson that I took from that. What I also did, and I've made that a habit throughout my career, was to enroll as a student myself in the courses, because quite apart from the intrinsic interest, if you're working in a distance teaching university, there is no better way of finding out whether the staff are telling you fairy tales about how good the courses are than to take those courses as a student yourself. So I did that, and so did my wife, and that was interesting. But I mean, going back to the personal thing, what was fascinating was that in 1977, there was an election in Quebec when the Separatist Party came to power, and four of my faculty members were elected to the Quebec National Assembly, and three of them became ministers. So these sort of long-haired nationalists suddenly all had to go out and buy suits and get used to being driven around in limousines, and it was really rather amusing to watch that. It turned out that it was actually one of the best governments that Quebec has ever had, because these were a highly educated bunch of people, many of them with degrees from Britain, the States, France, wherever. So it was a very, very interesting time. And because I was obviously the only Anglo in that setup, from that day forward, I never really had any fears of the Quebec nationalist movement because I knew a lot of these guys and they were super people. So that was really a very interesting experience on a personal front, as well as being a sort of the start of a new career. Going on to Athabasca, Athabasca, when I arrived there in 78, was starting up as an open university, after having been created to be an overspill campus for the University of Alberta, but they decided they didn't need that, so they made it into an open university. The lesson I learned there really was that it's better to do something, even if it's not perfect, than to spend all your life trying to find the perfect thing to do, if you follow me. I mean, when I got there, it seemed that at each meeting of the faculty senate, they were changing their minds about what courses they should produce. So I arrived and said, listen, let's actually just produce what you decided at the last meeting. And they all sort of were a bit surprised, but said, okay, let's do that. So we did that. And I think then, enrollments doubled for every year I was there, and we got the thing off to a good start. So that's more a management lesson than anything else. You know, the world's not perfect, but actually implement the best decision you can make, and then do it determinedly rather than constantly pulling up the tree by the roots to see how it's getting on. After that, I moved to Concordia University, which is not a distance teaching university. Concordia is a large downtown university in Montreal that specializes in part-time students. It had been created by the merger of Sir George Williams University, where I'd been a student in this educational technology program, and Loyola College. So I was the vice rector academic. I think I learned several things there, but the two I'd single out were, first of all, I was responsible for all the personnel matters. And this was a time when the faculty in Quebec were unionizing both the full-time and the part-time faculty. So steering the university through that process of negotiating first contracts with unions, I really had to cut my teeth on the whole industrial relations scene, which is not always pleasant, but was certainly, I think, a great asset later in my career. But I think the second lesson was simply the excitement of competing with McGill University across the street, with a great deal less money and a much more diverse student body. And I think we did a pretty good job of beating McGill to the draw when it came to identifying new subjects and getting programs up in them. And it was a terrifically vibrant place. The faculty came from all over the world, as did the student body. And a lot of these students were first generation. In fact, they were often sometimes right off the boat themselves. So it really was a place where the new generation of Canadians were equipping themselves to contribute to that society. So that was a most interesting experience too. Perhaps I should pause there and see whether you have any supplementaries on any of that.
Oh, I'm just quite enthused with all of the insights you're sharing and the experiences. So, no, continue, please.
So anyway, after that, I went off to Sudbury, Ontario, as president of Laurentian University. Laurentian University at that time had its main campus in Sudbury, which is a mining town in northern Ontario, and three affiliated campuses, one in North Bay, one in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, and one in a place called Hearst, which was 600 kilometers north of Sudbury on the Hudson's Bay lowlands, a small French language college on the route, the truck route from Toronto through to the west of Canada, that most truckers take. You go way north and then you drive on the fairly flat Hudson's Bay lowlands for hundreds of kilometers towards Winnipeg. And Hearst was a little town of a few thousand people up there, which had got this little college, which at that time was in the Guinness Book of Records as the world's smallest university. So anyway, it was tremendous fun holding all this together and running this multi-campus operation. I was, again, it was politically interesting because when I moved to Ontario, I was probably the first person ever appointed to head an Ontario university who'd never actually set foot on the campus of the University of Toronto, which was sort of what everyone looked up to as the Mecca. And the other thing which was difficult was that the Conservative government in Ontario had been in power for 40 years. So I thought, my goodness, how the heck does one break into this kind of establishment? But a few months after I arrived, there was an election and a new government came in, a Liberal government under a Prime Minister called David Peterson, who was highly favorable to northern development. He was highly favorable to the development of French language programs in Ontario, and Laurentian was a bilingual university. So all of a sudden, we were really on a roll as a very well-positioned institution for the new government priorities. So my 6 years at Laurentian were very happy years. Sudbury is a mining town, and the rather robust union style of the town infected the university a bit. So my training in industrial relations came in quite handy as we faced down a few strikes over the course of the time I was there. But it was a great time of development for the university. And I think one of the lessons I learned was that when you're leading universities, you've got to play it long. And the seeds that you plant, it may well be your successor or your successor's successor who actually sees them come out of the ground. The example there would be that with my vice president, Charles Bélanger, we started campaigning for a medical school in northern Ontario, because at that time, people who had cancer and so on had to go 400 kilometers south to Toronto to get treated. And this was really a burden for their families and everything else. Well, in those days, we're talking the late 80s. I mean, they just laughed at us when we talked about a medical school in northern Ontario. But lo and behold, in the first decade of this century, that medical school has been created as a joint operation between Laurentian University and Lakehead University in Thunder Bay. So, you know, if you have an idea, then if you and your successors keep pushing it, sooner or later it will be achieved. And in the same way, in those days in the 80s, Laurentian University was still very much in its infancy as regards research, whereas now it is actually a very strong player in some of the fields that it should be a strong player in, like mining, engineering, geology, and so on. So I suppose that those are the lessons that I learned there. It also had a distance learning program as a sideline rather than its main operation. And I think I learned there a lesson which I've never forgotten, which is that it is much more difficult to run what we call a dual mode institution that teaches both on campus and at a distance than a university that does either one or the other. And this is important these days because almost all universities are trying to be dual mode, and I think many of them are not making a big success at it. So that was Laurentian, and ever since I'd been at the Open University for my internship, I'd stayed in touch with it. So, and I still thought that was the Mecca, and that was the absolute, that running the Open University must be the best academic job in the world. So when it became vacant in 1989, I put in an application. I thought it was a complete long shot because I'd been out of Britain for 25 years by that time, and the Brits like to know who they're appointing. But I thought I owed it to myself to at least give it a whirl. So I applied, and somewhat to my surprise, got appointed. So in 1990, I headed back to Britain, having been a volunteer unpaid. 25 years later, I found myself It was 18 years later, I found myself in the top job. So that was a whole other chapter of my career opening up.
So that would be a fascinating experience for you, though, right? Being at that top job, and what was that like?
Well, I think many people thought that it would be difficult to move to what was already by then Britain's biggest university, having not been in Britain for 25 years and having only had experience of British universities as an undergraduate. But in fact, I found it exactly the reverse. What was important was that I had experience of distance learning and open universities. And that experience, I think, was much more helpful, and in a kind of perverse way, not knowing where all the bodies were buried in the British higher education system was in some ways an advantage, because I had the sort of naivety of the innocent. Furthermore, it has to be said that within a year or so of my arrival, there was a complete reform of British higher education, which led to a repositioning of many institutions. And so I was able to take the British Open University, if you like, through the run-up to that reform. And I like to think that we did rather well. I mentioned that at Athabasca, when I went there, the problem was that they were changing their minds all the time about what they should do and were not very good at implementing it. In some ways, the Open University was the other way round. They were extremely good at implementation. They had a really very efficient and effective system for doing things. But because they'd been a bit battered in the 1980s by the Thatcher government and accusations of being too left-wing and so on, they were very much on the defensive where government was concerned. And I think my contribution in the early days was to say, listen, you guys are world class. There is no better institution in the world doing what you're doing of distance teaching. You should be absolutely confident, and any review of what you're doing will show how good you are. So, you know, put your cards on the table when the government comes asking questions and show them what you're doing. And as a result of that, when the reforms of 1992 came in and the polytechnics became universities and all British universities were put on a more equal footing and the system became more federal at the same time with separate arrangements in Scotland, Wales, England and Northern Ireland, I like to think that the Open University was extremely well positioned, and in a curious way, having been somewhat on the margins by being funded directly by government rather than through the previous system of funding for universities, it suddenly became the only national university because it was active in all the home countries of the UK in a way that none of the others were. So that was a most interesting political experience. I suppose the second thing I'd mention at the Open University was that, I mean, it had always been a technology-based university and had always tried to keep up with the development of technology. But in 1995, I decided that we had to make an even more determined effort to get into the whole internet online world. So I persuaded the university council, without much difficulty, it has to be said, to invest £15 million, which was quite a lot of money in those days, into a number of projects to get us more into the world of the web. And I think we did that very successfully. The problem, of course, with a distance teaching university is that you can, to an extent, you can only go as fast as the students are prepared to go, because you have to essentially use the technology that students have in their homes. So in the early days, it was television. And gradually, of course, everyone acquired a television. And then it was audio tape recorders. And the process by which students acquired computers at home was a slow process and one that one had to manage, because there was a very egalitarian spirit in the Open University. And a lot of the students, particularly those in the Student Association, which was very powerful, had the attitude that if everyone can't have it, no one should have it. Well, obviously, this is a great obstacle to the introduction of any kind of technology. We managed to overcome that, I think partly by the rather devious trick of equipping the members of the Student Association Executive with computers and connections at home, so they could see, if you like, the advantages of this for themselves, and that converted them. The irony, of course, was that we were to some extent hoist by our own petard, because once they were connected, then they could canvass the 100,000 student body much more easily, so they could channel student beefs and student complaints through to us much more effectively than they ever could before. But, I mean, that was really an advantage, because it meant that we could keep our finger on the pulse of what was going well and what wasn't going well. So in a very few years, I remember, must have been about 1993, I made my annual speech at the Student Association Convention. And I always make, even from the early 90s, I always make my speeches from a laptop. So I scroll my text on a laptop. So I walked up to the podium with this laptop and made my speech. And they were in the middle of a debate about the fact that the university was moving too quickly on what was called its home computing policy, in other words, requiring students to have computers at home. So there was a kind of chill in the room that they could see I was using computers, and they were a bit dubious about them. But anyway, cut a long story short, 2 years later, when I made the same appointment and went to the Student Association conference, they were then complaining that we weren't moving fast enough, and that showed how quickly the psychology had changed over just a couple of years. And I think from then on, the Open University has remained the leader in the use of all kinds of educational technologies at scale. And at the moment, of course, it's very much involved in the social media, open educational resources, but always at scale. And this is one of my sort of pet things, that the whole point of educational technology, to my mind, is to do things at scale. And anything that's not at scale is really a bit of a waste of time and money. So that's where I've always come from.
You know, you introduced this idea of scale. So currently, do you have a sense of the number of students, the faculty, the budget of Open University in the UK?
The student body is somewhere in the region of a quarter of a million. I think it's 260,000. I met my successor, but Martin Bean, just recently. I mean, he's a very interesting guy, because they came to Canada to find me. My successor, Brenda Gourley, was from South Africa, and Martin is an Australian-American who was previously head of global education product development at Microsoft. So he was a most unusual appointment. Anyway, he's doing a terrific job keeping the Open University moving forward. But it's about 260,000 students. I couldn't tell you what the budget is. I mean, it must be in the region of, I would think, $500 million, but that's a guess. As I say, doing wonderful things. And the quarter of a million sort of students enrolled with the university are really only the tip of the iceberg, because the university has made a big commitment to open educational resources. So many of its course materials are freely available on its website, and they estimate that there are something like 10 million students worldwide who are using courses from their own institutions that actually are based on Open University courses that they've taken and adapted. So in that way, I think that they're having an impact, not just at scale with their own students all over the world, but also by allowing all universities to have access to very high quality, if you like, self-learning materials that they can adapt and use. I mean, they're not the only university doing this. MIT, I think, would be, you would say, was the pioneer of this open courseware movement. But MIT stuff was more in the early days the faculty's lecture notes, whereas what the Open University is putting up on its Open Learn website are, if you like, highly produced self-learning materials. And they've got sidelines like, I think they're one of the largest players on iTunes U, the millions of downloads from that. So they're playing now a worldwide role, really, as the leading producer of high-quality learning materials that anyone can use and adapt for their own purposes.
Do you have a sense, then, of what percentage of their course offerings are in the open courseware arena?
No, I don't. I mean, I'd guess it's probably still reasonably small. I mean, it's probably about a quarter of their offerings. They must have about, I don't know, I'm guessing 300 programs, and parts of probably about, I don't know, 100 programs will be on there. But I mean, anyone who wants to know should just simply go to the Open Learn website and see what's there. They're putting more and more stuff on as they sort of see a demand for it, and as their faculty have courses that they'd like to put up there. And as I say, they're putting more and more things on iTunes U. So it's become very much part of the Open University way of doing business to open it up to the world. Now you may say, well, isn't that a bit risky? Because after all, if your whole business is open learning, if you put it all out there free, then aren't you giving away the family jewels, so to speak? But they have studied this rather carefully, and I think they've shown, and again, I won't have the figures exactly right, but I think they found that in the last year there was something like 10 million downloads of material from the website, as a result of which they've been able to track 6,000 students who have enrolled as students in the university as a direct result of using that material. So, if you like, there is a throughput. But Martin Bead, my successor, I mean, he very strongly believes that it is part of the role of the university, as he puts it, to provide people with a route out of the informal cloud of learners, this vast group of people who are dabbling in some form of learning, and give them a route that can lead them into some more formal kind of learning so that they can get certification in accredited courses and so on. Because at the end of the day, most people will want some recognition of the learning that they've done. And this, I think, is one of the great questions nowadays. There's so much out there, but if you want to be recognized, certified, get a diploma, then you need to go through some sort of a formal process. And making these two fit together is, for me, one of the great challenges of the day, which we're working on at the Commonwealth of Learning.
You know, but this also speaks to this whole, and you talked about this earlier, you know, social media and sort of grassroots movement and really democratizing everything out there so it's available to anyone and at very low cost. So I just think this is amazing that all of this is made available and it's highly produced versus, let's say, a lot of the MIT material, which is rather crude.
Yeah, I mean, you said that, not me. I think MIT is constantly raising its game. I mean, when they did it at first, I'm sure there was a certain skepticism, and they thought, well, let's just throw this stove over the wall and see what happens. And of course, they threw it over the wall with serious funding from the Hewlett Foundation. I think they were surprised by the extent to which people looked at it, particularly the extent to which people looked at it in places like China. And it's since become, I think, an important sort of part of MIT's identity to do this. But it doesn't, I mean, I'm sure that there are students who come to MIT as a result of that, but of course MIT is not in the business of is not short of students and is not competing for students, if you like. So it's a different kind of social mission, and of course lots more people are doing it now. We at the Commonwealth of Learning have this fascinating program called the Virtual University for Small States of the Commonwealth, where 32 small countries are working together to produce courses as open educational resources, which they can then all use and adapt in places like Trinidad and Tobago, Samoa, Maldives, because these countries, if you like, are too small or they think they're too small to have the critical mass to do all the E thing by themselves. So they work together in this virtual university, and by creating everything as open educational resources, then not only can each of them adapt and use it, but also anyone in the world can adapt and use it. So we're very strongly supportive at the Commonwealth of Learning of this open educational resource movement. And in fact, we're now moving it into the secondary school arena. We've got five African countries and Trinidad and Tobago working together to produce a complete senior secondary curriculum as open educational resources, which again will be able to be used not just in those six countries, but by any other country or school system that finds the material useful and interesting.
Wow, absolutely fascinating. I'm now going to shift the questions into some of your best-selling books. For example, what lessons can you share from your book, Mega Universities and Knowledge Media, Technology Strategies for Higher Education?
Well, I think I go back to this question of scale. That book was written because at the time I wrote it, the demand for higher education around the world was rising so fast that I think my calculation was that you would need to open one brand new conventional university every week in order to cope with it. And therefore, the world should pay a lot more attention to these big, what I called mega universities. I defined a mega university then as a distance teaching university with over 100,000 students. Since then, they have multiplied and grown, and there are at least three mega universities that now have over 1 million students. So that movement, if you like, has prospered. But I was also interested, the term knowledge media had been coined by a guy called Mark Eisenstadt, who was a colleague at the British Open University. And I thought it was an important term because it seems to me that the knowledge media, by which I mean the online media, are really qualitatively different from the older media, like television and radio, in that they engage the academics much more. It was always quite hard to engage academics with televised courses and so on. But because the IT and computing has to do with the manipulation of symbols, numbers, and words, which is, after all, the heart of the academic endeavor, academics didn't need telling that this was important. So they got into computing and IT in a way they never had with the older media. That didn't mean they were ready to use it in their teaching very quickly, but nevertheless, there was a kind of favorable prejudice towards these media. And part of the book was really to try and move that debate to a slightly more sophisticated level, to take a word like interaction, which is a sort of buzzword that everyone uses in higher education and learning, and to try and be a bit more demanding on how we use that word. So I got into the work of Diana Lorillard, who for my money is one of the clearest thinkers about educational technology and conversation theory and all this kind of thing, but also into the subtitle was Technology Strategies for Higher Education. So really the management aspects of how does a university move forward in developing a technology strategy, whether it's an open university or whether it's a campus university. And I hope it was a useful contribution. Certainly it seemed to strike a chord at the time, and was interesting because it got me back into more scholarship, if you like. And just to complete the bookend to my earlier comments about studying educational technology, I should have confessed that after I'd done the coursework and the internship, I dropped out of that program. And it wasn't until the 1990s that I re-entered it under some special dispensation from a very understanding Concordia University to finish the program. So mega universities began as my thesis for the MA program in educational technology. So after 25 years, I finally finished the program and got my degree. And I always used to tell students at the Open University who complained that it took too long to finish their degrees that I'd taken 25 years to finish a degree, so that I was a real lifelong learner. Anyway, so turning that into a book and seeing it make an impact was very gratifying.
Can you then share more lessons from your more recent book, and that is Mega Schools, Technology and Teachers, Achieving Education for All?
Yes, well, that really was an attempt to do some advocacy for what seemed to me to be the two biggest educational problems facing the world, and which are two of our key initiatives at the Commonwealth of Learning. The first is what some people call the secondary surge. I mentioned earlier that when I was at UNESCO, the big thing that we were all working on was universal primary education. And that has actually been really quite successful. Some countries still won't make it by 2015, but most countries are well on the way. The problem was that no one, neither the World Bank nor anyone else, really stopped to think, what do we do if we're successful? They were so transfixed with the idea of getting this to happen that they didn't stop to think of what would happen if they did. Well, of course, they did. And the result is there's a tidal wave of students, of pupils coming out of primary school, and they want something else because they know perfectly well that they're not going to make successful lives just on the basis of primary education. So there are, by someone's estimate, 400 million children between the ages of 12 and 17 who are not in secondary school. That's a lot of children. I mean, I live in Canada, then that's more than 10 times the total population of Canada. And those children will never get into conventional bricks and mortar secondary schools in any foreseeable future. There just isn't the resource to do that. So half of the book is promoting open schooling, which is the application of distance learning methods and local study centers to secondary schooling. And curiously, the Commonwealth of Learning, although we're a tiny organization, seems to have become the sort of primary driver and advocate for this around the world. And I think we're making some progress by working with the very big existing open schools, like the one in India, which has 1.5 million pupils, and others. So I think, but I wanted to put some sort of intellectual muscle behind that movement, and to sort of alert people to the fact that, you know, we haven't finished universal primary, but we've got to move on and look at another problem, which is universal secondary. The second half of the book is about the teacher problem. There is a massive shortage of teachers, which UNESCO estimates at about 10 million new teachers needed within the next 5-10 years. And they, again, will not be produced by adding a few people to the existing schools of education. So you need to do, distance methods to train teachers at scale. But what you also need is that teacher education, I think, has to some extent lost its way and needs to be focused much more on the reality of the classroom. So the great advantage of distance learning is that you can take the teacher education into the schools so that the teachers are, if you like, doing their education at the same time as they're teaching. So you've got this constant interaction between learning and doing, which in every field is proved to be the most effective way of learning. And this is already happening on a large scale. I mentioned open educational resources. There's a wonderful program called Teacher Education in Sub-Saharan Africa, whereby 12 African universities are producing open educational resources for classroom-based teacher education. And these are being used by about 500,000 teachers in a dozen African countries at the moment, and are having a terrific impact. Just 2 days ago, I saw a report from Uganda where a teacher was saying, I've got a class of 80 students, which in Uganda is actually not a big class. And suddenly this TESA program and the courses that I'm able to take has put the fun back into teaching and made me do a much better job, because it relates to the reality of my day-to-day job as a teacher of these very large classes. So that's the second half of the book. And in both halves, I give a number of profiles of institutions around the world that are using the technologies of distance learning to do both secondary schooling and teacher education at scale. So it's early days on that. But what was interesting was that that book was published almost simultaneously in Chinese, and from an email I got this morning, appears to be doing very well in China. So that's interesting too.
You know, you were knighted by Queen Elizabeth for services to higher education in 1994. Can you describe this experience and how this has helped you in your work?
Well, first of all, it was a complete surprise. I'd only been in Britain for 4 years when that came along, and it was the last thing on my mind. It's an interesting experience, because you get this highly conditional letter from the Prime Minister's private secretary, which says that the Prime Minister has it in mind. He hasn't decided, but he has it in mind to recommend to Her Majesty the Queen that she be graciously pleased to award you the honour of knighthood in the next list of honours. And then it ends, please signify on the attached form whether you would accept this honour. If offered, you will receive no further communication until the list is published. So you sort of fill in the form and send it off, and then wait. Meanwhile, my wife freaked out, because she's American and she wasn't sure whether it was okay for an American to become a lady. But anyway, we got through all that, and the list was duly published and my name was on it. And a few weeks later, we went to Buckingham Palace, where the Queen touched me on both shoulders with a sword and talked to me about what I'd done. It was a wonderful, wonderful, simple, but very moving ceremony. The other part of your question actually is extremely difficult to answer. I've no idea how it's helped me in my work, because, you know, you can't know what would have happened otherwise. I think there's no question that my colleagues at the Open University and here at the Commonwealth of Learning are rather pleased that they have a knight in charge. But meanwhile, I had the period at UNESCO, and UNESCO doesn't use titles of any kind, whether it's doctor, professor, sir, or whatever. So I spent my 4 years at UNESCO, like everyone else, being Mister, which was a good experience. So, you know, I can't really tell you, but I'm very proud of that, and it's been very meaningful to me, and is still something of a surprise, because, as I say, I wasn't expecting it. But in a way, it has, I think, the credibility is not just a credibility for me. It does, I think, confer a credibility on the whole field of distance learning, which I'm rather pleased with too.
Yeah, I'm thinking that it'll increase your reach or the ability to build relationships as well.
Yeah, you probably get your calls returned and your emails returned more than you might otherwise, and you get invited to give speeches more, I think. But as I say, you can't know. You know, it's that this great Latin tag post hoc ergo propter hoc, because it happened after something, did it happen because of something? And you can never answer that question.
I guess I'll preface this question with Sir John. As past president of both the International Council for Open and Distance Education and the Canadian Association for Distance Education, and vice president of the International Baccalaureate Organization, can you sort of share some of your best practices in distance education?
Well, I think in distance education, the longer you're in the field, I mean, first of all, distance education isn't that complicated. People make a hell of a meal of it, whereas in fact it's fairly straightforward. And I can't really hold more than three things in my head at the same time. So I have two trios that I keep wheeling out. The first is the triangle of access, cost, and quality. And the argument I make is that if you put these three vectors of access, cost, and quality into a triangle, it is an iron triangle for conventional education. Because if you're teaching people in a classroom and you try and vary one of those variables, you make the others worse. If you put more kids in the classroom, then people will say you're taking the quality down. If you add in more learning materials, you're taking the cost up. So the great revolution of distance learning and technology is that you can make that iron triangle flexible, and you can increase access, you can decrease cost, and you can improve quality all at the same time. I mean, this is the real revolution in education. Never happened before. And this is why these open universities, if they're properly run, have been so successful. I mean, the open university has massively increased access. I mean, there are far more students in the open university alone now than there were in all universities in Britain put together in the year when it was created. It operates at a much lower cost than the other universities, and the quality is recognized worldwide as you know, without rival. So that's number one. And number two is simply to think of distance learning as a three-legged stool, which has three components. One of them is course development. The second is logistics and administration. And the third is student support. And if any one of those legs is weak, the stool will collapse and the student will fall down. So any institution that wants to do it well has got to operate successfully on all those fronts. There's no point in producing brilliant study materials if you can't get them to your students successfully by either traditional or online means. And similarly, while some students can survive on independent study, most need some kind of support from other people, and ways of providing that support that are efficient and effective are the other thing that basically sorts out the sheep from the goats. So those are basically the sort of lessons I keep kind of drum home to people on distance learning. The International Baccalaureate was an interesting experience, being on the council of that. And I think, I suppose what I learned there was that it is quite useful to have a situation where you have a chair and a vice chair who can, when necessary, do a soft cop, hard cop routine. The chair of the council of the International Baccalaureate at the time that I was there was a splendid Australian politician called Greg Crafter, who is a wonderfully affable and urbane man. But we had to take the International Baccalaureate through some quite difficult times in the late 90s. And so I was, if you like, the hard cop who had to use the elbows a bit more behind the scenes so that Greg could remain the urbane chair and keep everyone happy. But it's a wonderful program. And during that time, we introduced, when I joined the council, there was just the IB diploma, the two-year end of high school diploma, which has been hugely successful and is accepted worldwide as a sort of one of the top ways of getting into university. But we also introduced a middle years program and a primary years program. These are not examined diplomas, but they're curricula which the IB sort of oversees and makes schools go through a process before they can offer them. And I think those two have been very successful. So I've been very proud of being associated with that program. What I would like to see it do, which is happening much more slowly than I would prefer, is to see it become offered on a much larger scale, to see the IB diploma offered at a distance so that it can reach a much larger group of people. Because at the moment, I think it's fair to say it's still rather an elite program. And the problem is that the schools that offer it want it to stay an elite program. There's no interest on their part in making it more widely available. And this is the classic educational challenge. You know, how do you get away from an education which is marketed on its exclusivity into something that can reach the generality of people. I mean, that's been the thing that's kept me going all my career, and I wish the IB would move a bit faster in loosening up on that one.
Can you sort of outline then your current roles and your goals?
Well, the Commonwealth of Learning for me has been almost the perfect job because it brings together the three things that I've done, as we've been talking about, institutional leadership, but having led an institution as big as the Open University with over 10,000 staff and hundreds of thousands of students, it's nice to lead a small organization where, if you like, the management and the administration doesn't take up all your time. It's also, of course, its mission is to promote and help countries use technology and open and distance learning, which has been, as I've been saying, my career, and of course it's international development, which I came to late through UNESCO, but which is now very much part of my identity. So I've got the perfect job, which brings together the three things that I like doing, and I suppose my goal, quite simply, is to make the Commonwealth of Learning respected as the most effective intergovernmental organization. We're obviously very small, but I think there's a percentage to being small and excellent rather than trying to grow. And we compensate for being small by having a very large network of partners and collaborators, and also, I think, by constantly striving to develop models so that when we see that something works, we know why it works, and therefore we know what questions to ask if we want to move it to another country. So whether it's in open schooling or whether it's in rural development or whether it's in open educational resources, to really understand why this thing works and then spread the model. Because obviously, even if everything that the Commonwealth of Learning does is endlessly sustainable, it's a drop in the bucket. But if we show people models that are so obviously effective that they replicate themselves, then we can have an impact. And that's basically what we're trying to do.
What's your perspective then on the Asia-Pac region, specifically India and China, you know, considering the enormity of their populations and the fact that there is some investment in infrastructure and in education?
Yes, well, India, I spend a lot of time in India, which is an absolutely fascinating place. And they are expanding their education system as fast as they can. And, of course, in the Indian educational system, there is everything from soup to nuts. I mean, there are some very good institutions, there are some pretty ropey ones. But the developments there are dizzying. In fact, my next book, which I'm writing with a colleague at UNESCO, is going to be about about developing universities in developing countries and how they've probably got to take a slightly different route to the traditional one that's been taken in the West. China is already the largest higher education system in the world, but India will overtake it if the Indian projections are correct, so that by 2020, the US, which was the largest until very recently, will probably be about number three. So this is changing very fast. And of course, both India and China are making very big commitments to distance learning because they just have to because of the numbers.
This leads us to this next question then. And what are the major challenges that you are facing, and what are the solutions to these challenges?
Well, I think the major challenge we've touched on several times is scale. And I think in general, educational technology is an answer to that. Open educational resources and getting them into the bloodstream, the mainstream, is another challenge. The point about open educational resources is that the most difficult thing to reduce the cost of is the production of good courseware, because that costs money, because it's people, it's experts, and so on. But if, as we've talked in the case of the Open University, you can use and adapt material that's already available, then that's brilliant. And of course, the key word is adaptation, because no course from anywhere else is ever exactly what you want. But if you can freely adapt it to your needs, then you start with a great advantage, and you can do things less expensively. The next frontier for us here at Commonwealth of Learning is mobiles. 5 years ago, I thought that the development of IT in the developing world was going to take place by following the Western trajectory through laptops. Clearly, that's no longer the case. Mobiles is where it's at, and we are busy using mobiles in countries like India and Africa, linking a mobile phone system to a learning management system so that you can reach very large numbers of people with lessons, audio mode lessons, not SMS, and quizzes at the end of it and so on and so forth. I mean, this is, again, it's in its infancy, but I think mobiles have a huge potential in the developing world to leapfrog into another kind of learning. Fourth point I'd make is the use of the word community. I think driving things back to the community level is an important objective, as in putting the community back into community radio and thinking through the concept of communities of academics developing open educational resources and things like that. All of this very much with a focus on students. So I think I'd stop at that list of particular challenges, although I'm sure there are some others.
And then I guess the reverse side is, what do you see as the major innovations and opportunities? And you've touched on some of them already. And then what actions can be taken to take advantage of these opportunities?
Yes, well, open educational resources, still, I think, very much a buyer's market. I mean, there are more people eager to produce them than there are to use them, and we've got to change that. And we've also got to make it a multi-directional flow. Some people in Africa accuse the open educational resource movement of being neo-colonialist, where, if you like, the North rams its OERs down the throat of the South. But that's changing. There are already open educational resources from Africa being used in the US, and that's as it should be. Open schooling, very important, only still at the foothills of that. That has got to grow, and that means that people like the World Bank and so on have got to get on board with that. Sooner or later, presumably, we will crack the issue of computers in schools and use them effectively. And the cheaper that computers get, the better. We've got a little unit in India, the Commonwealth of Learning, and they've now produced a laptop computer for $75, which is being used on a trial basis in schools in the Maldives. So sooner or later, we'll get there on computers in schools, but it's too early to cry victory yet. And I'm very, very hopeful of this project I mentioned called the Virtual University for Small States of the Commonwealth as a laboratory for using technology in 32 small countries spread all around the world that have fragile economies, fragile ecosystems, and are very susceptible to natural disasters, but are inhabited by wonderful people and are tourist destinations for the rest of the world. So we're very proud to be associated with them.
Now, if we can sort of broaden the outlook, then what do you see as the top global forces shaping education?
The secondary surge, the fact that there are these millions of children who are not getting secondary schooling, number one. Number two, the teacher shortage. Number three, the general expansion of higher education. All projections of higher education enrollments in the past have proved to be underestimates. Fourthly, that will not happen without much greater use of the private sector. So people have got to get used to the idea of private higher education, and by that I mean for-profit higher education, which means that governments have got to put in place sensible regulatory frameworks and tax frameworks, and the private for-profit people have got to clean up their act and be a little less secretive and play by the rules. But they have a very important part of the future. And of course, you'd expect me to say the good use of technology across the piece.
It smiles because, well, I'm smiling, I should say, because throughout this conversation, we've been talking about technology. You've mentioned it throughout. So I want to kind of segue into this question then. You know, there's this program by the International Federation for Information Processing. It's called IP3, and it's a program to professionalize IT, to make it a profession, to have code of standards and quality standards and continuing professional development and globally recognized credentialing and so on. What do you think about this?
Well, I think it's great. And in fact, my own organization, the Commonwealth of Learning, is signed up to that. And we've tried to follow it and if you like, follow that practice. I think it's very important. And part of the reason it's very important is because it's actually very difficult. It's a bit like nailing jello to a tree, really, because this is such a fast moving field that you've got to, I think very carefully about how you define standards and how you professionalize the area so that you're not constantly producing a kind of capability definition for a skill that's no longer needed. But there must be generic ways of approaching it, which I'm sure people more qualified than I can come up with. But it is very important. Most of the people, certainly of my generation, who got into this, got into it through a different route. Now, of course, lots and lots of people are doing degrees in computer science and so on, with all kinds of different flavors. But I think that's a very important move, because after all, you know, society is now so dependent on the good use of IT that we need to know the people who present themselves to work in it know what they're doing. It goes back to this item we discussed a bit earlier, that the balance between learning from the freely available cloud of things that are out there, but also doing it in a way that someone with authority certifies that, yes, you can do this, and you have had the training necessary to be capable in the area that you claim to be capable in.
You know, Sir John, you are considered one of the most respected and globally recognized leaders and scholars in education, and a remarkable background, and you're contributing to history into the future. You have done so in the past, a major impact really historically, and it's reverberating and will continue to do so. So within that context, you know, what are some pivotal lessons that you want to share from this history of national international success?
Number one, a quality culture. I worry when I see institutions getting sloppy, because education at all levels, but particularly technology-based education, has to have terrific attention to detail, not leaving things to chance. That leads you straight into number two, I guess, which is student-centeredness. At the end of the day, it's the students who count, so you're doing everything for them. Action orientation, we mentioned this earlier. You can spend a lot of time spinning your wheels trying to figure out what the best thing to do is, but if you do something that's good and do it well, then you'll add to the sort of value of society. Listen to people. This was something that came across very powerfully from a splendid woman in India that I heard at our recent conference, who created a bank for rural women in India. And she described how almost everything she did at this bank, she did as a result of listening to these illiterate women telling her what was really necessary. So I think those, and then if you're leading an institution, I think it's very important to continually polish and present the vision of that institution. When I was at the Open University, the motto, if you like, of the Open University is openness to people, openness to places, openness to methods, and openness to ideas. And I don't think I ever gave a speech in which that did not appear somewhere. So keeping everyone associated with the institution clear about what the vision is seems to me to be a very important key to unlock the future.
And you talk about the future, so if you could provide your predictions of future trends, what would they be? And where you have sort of freedom of choosing any area?
Well, we just touched on one in the IT sphere, which I think is a focus on competencies and defining those. And that leads into what I would call controlled openness. I often make the analogy with engineering structures that if a structure is too rigid, it will break. And if it's too flexible, it will fall down and collapse. And what you've got to aim for is something that's, if you like, tough, that's sufficiently rigid to stand up and sufficiently flexible to move a reasonable amount when there's a strain on it. And that analogy I carry over into education, that one should innovate, one should be open, but it's dangerous to do it on too many fronts at once. And I worry sometimes about the open educational practice movement that, you know, if this idea of the sort of do-it-yourself university, it only takes you so far because, as we've been saying, at the end of the day, someone in authority has to say, yes, you have this competency, you can do whatever it is that you're claiming to be able to do. Which I think brings me to the last point on that question, and that is, in a curious way, I think we may be going back to something that happened 150 years ago, which was when the University of London launched its external studies program. And what the University of London said was, look, we will offer examinations. How you get the knowledge and skills needed to pass those examinations is your problem. But we will offer a highly credible examination, and if you pass it, then you get your degree, and if you don't, then that's tough. That led, of course, to a whole development of schools tutoring to the University of London external program and so on and so forth, which, be it said, has produced 5 Nobel Prize winners, so it's a good program. But that's tended to sort of get forgotten as all institutions both teach and examine, especially in the United States. I think we may be on our way back to a version of that where fewer bodies examine, and students can take advantage of this whole cloud of courseware and learning possibilities in order to prepare for a credible examination which they challenge. Now, this, of course, is totally radical and very, very scary to those institutions that rely on having kids come to their classroom that they can then teach and then examine. But the world is changing, and I think that's going to be one of the things to watch.
For those listening in the audience, I guess the question then arises, you know, we've talked about all the different facets of education, distance education, the challenges, the opportunities, the trends, and all the different kinds of forces that are involved. If people want to find more information or they want to look into this deeper, what are your top recommended resources?
Well, I would certainly recommend a good place to start is our own website at www.col.org, the Commonwealth of Learning. That's a sort of gateway to a whole lot of other stuff, because we see ourselves as probably the world's leading knowledge source on everything to do with distance learning technology in education. But obviously there are lots more out there. I think anyone should go and take a look at the Open Learn website at the Open University. That's all one word, Open Learn. And then I think follow your nose after that, because the nice thing today is that everything is interconnected, and you can pretty quickly find your way from one place to another. So those are the places that I would start. Certainly we're very gratified, although we're a tiny organization, the Commonwealth of Learning, I'm constantly gratified by meeting people who say, I came to your website, it's absolutely amazing, you have all these resources. You know, why didn't you tell people about this? Well, I guess we don't have the money to tell people about it, but we hope they'll find it themselves. But as I say, there's lots more. The World Bank has lots of stuff. If you're following technology and education, Mike Tricano at the World Bank has a very good blog which doesn't miss much that goes on. And our own website blog lists a whole bunch of other bloggers in the educational technology area around the world. So, I mean, the last point I'd make really is for people to be alert to the rest of the world. And I address this particularly to Americans who are terrible at thinking that the world ends at the frontiers of the United States. Whereas in fact, there are terrific things going on in India, China, OER Africa is now becoming a powerhouse for open educational resources. There are some tremendously exciting things going on in the rest of the world. So, you know, follow your nose where it leads you, and don't fall for the idea that if it's not happening in the United States, it's not happening anywhere, because it's simply not true. And it's particularly not true in areas like the use of mobile phones for learning, where North America is not really a serious player because we don't need it. But in the rest of the world, it's big.
You know, I have a sizable U.S. audience. I'm sure I'll get emails on this one. We're down to our last two questions. And the first one of this of the two is that if you could share some of your stories, you know, one or more stories, maybe something surprising or unexpected, amazing or humorous from your work.
Oh, well, in one, a lot happened at the sort of international meetings that I was at when I was at UNESCO. We used to have these regular meetings on Education for All, where we get together the what we call the E9, the nine biggest developing countries, to sort of talk to them about the progress they were making in universal primary education. And I often found myself sitting next to the Minister of Education from India, a man called Murali Manohar Joshi, who was from the Hindu Nationalist Party, always very smartly dressed in what we call Gandhi chic. Anyways, a physics teacher by profession. And he always began his speech at these meetings by saying that when the British came to India, they found a very good pre-existing village-based education system, which they destroyed. And what a terrible thing this was. Well, I thought for a long time that Joshi was saying this really to give me the needle as a Brit. But then I discovered that, in fact, it was true. And Gandhi had made this comment back in the 1930s in Britain. And there's a wonderful book that was published last year called The Beautiful Tree by James Tooley, which is all about the pre-existing Indian education system that in fact was a good system, but the Brits came in and put in a more sort of colonial top-down system. So it was kind of amusing to discover that Joshi had been right and I'd been wrong. The other vignette from those meetings was the terrific cultural difference between the press in various countries. I remember a post-meeting press conference in Beijing, and you saw the terrific difference between the different cultures. The Chinese reporters would sort of lob really soft questions at their minister, who would lob really soft and sort of boilerplate answers back. The Indians were a bit more robust, but the Nigerians really got into it. And it was terrific fun watching the Nigerian journalists go after their minister, and their minister, who was quite used to this, go after them in a robust fashion. And it reminded me just how very different world cultures are in that way, you know, as regards openness, deference, and so on. A lesson in humility from another job. When I was president of Laurentian University in Sudbury, we had a champion swimmer among our student body, a guy called Alex Bauman, who came back with three gold medals from the Los Angeles Olympics. And every lunchtime when I would go swimming for my exercise, Bauman would be practicing. And it was rather good for a university president to see a student dive into the pool and do three lengths before he'd done one. So, and he was a wonderful guy, Alex Bauman, too, and he's still very much involved in the whole Olympic movement. And I think that the last and most recent really moving impression, I was in India, and we have a program called Lifelong Learning for Farmers, which is a rural development program, very much grassroots based, to help people become more prosperous in the villages of India. And it happens in India, in fact, it's true in most of the developing world, people don't know this, that most farmers are now women. Anyway, we had a meeting where 6,000 women farmers came together in a village marriage hall in southern India to essentially present a petition signed by 25,000 of them to the Reserve Bank of India, which is the Indian Central Bank, with recommendations about how they could do rural credit much better if they would insist on a kind of learning element for the people who receive credit in order to improve their prosperity by changing the way they farm. This is very much the program we've been involved in. But that was such a moving experience, and in a way a bit like the Bowman swimming experience. Here I was in front of these 6,000 women making my little speech. But of course they didn't understand a word of English, and I knew they didn't understand a word of English. So I was there speaking. Fortunately, my good colleague Balasubramanian, who speaks Tamil, was translating sentence by sentence in a very animated way, so they understood what I was trying to say. But it was a lovely example of the reality of development. These 6,000 literate or illiterate or semi-literate women who are becoming more prosperous through an approach to farming that is improving their livelihoods, but coming together to distill those recommendations into something they can send on to the authorities in India to change the way that the banking system deals with this. It was a very moving moment, and I think I'll finish on that.
Those are great stories that you've shared, and I know the audience will very much appreciate them. We're now down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables and say, you know, what kind of questions would you ask if you were doing the interview, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I'll touch on some things we've already mentioned. I'd still like to ask the question, why have computers in schools been a relative disappointment so far? And I don't think I have the answer. I think part of the answer lies in a wonderful project called The Hole in the Wall in India, which gave rise to the movie Slumdog Millionaire. And that is that the Hole in the Wall project, which involves putting computers in slum playgrounds, is of the firm idea that it is by having children work together on computers that good things happen, whereas a lot of the Western approach has been it must be one laptop per child. But then there will be other answers, and we'll crack that one day. The other much deeper question is why educators and the general public are so wedded to this idea that quality in education has to be related to exclusivity. The old idea, which still, frankly, guides the admissions policies of most universities, that we define our quality by the people we exclude. And yet, you know, we're in an era where education can be available to everyone. So why do we continue to be obsessed with making it exclusive? I don't have an answer to that question, except Einstein's answer that you can't convert old people to new ideas, but old people die off. So I think the new generation that has grown up in a world of educational abundance will be a little less wedded to the idea that to be good, educational has to be exclusive. Thirdly, I've got four of these. The third, I think, is how will the world react to a successful and overwhelming China? I understand there was some trauma in the US last week when the latest results of the OECD's International Program of Student Assessment, PISA, were published, and the city of Shanghai was pretty well off the charts. I mean, they were so far ahead of the US it wasn't even funny, but they were also ahead of the traditional winners in these league tables of school performance, Finland, Macau, and so on. That's not the whole of China, but I think it is a straw in the wind, and I think that's going to be quite difficult for many people to adjust to the fact that you've not only got this very large country, but a very high-performing country intellectually, and that's going to change the world. And I think my last thought is to really say that we should be aware that technology can actually go backwards. Not all technology is progress. I'm convinced, for example, that the latest Word package is actually less good, less effective, less user-friendly than the one that preceded it. But because of the way we're controlled by the desktop, we don't have a choice. We've got to move to it, even if it's actually going backwards. And to very finely generalize that that idea, Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, seems to me one that should be on the desk of anyone doing technology in education, because what he is arguing is that some of the new technologies actually are weakening our brains and our power to reason rather than strengthening them. And if true, that is a very considerable worry. So while I'm a great fan of technology, I'm a great fan of the intelligent use of technology, and that we must not let technology dumb our critical functions so that we can't make judgments about it as human beings.
I am just amazed at sort of the insights that you provide in every one of your sort of thoughtful answers. It's just amazing. You know, I've really enjoyed this experience, and you're just a remarkable individual, as I've indicated earlier, a global leader, and, you know, we will continue to follow your significant historical contributions, and we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. It's been a much longer interview than I expected, but I've enjoyed it, and I hope that some of those who listen to all or parts of it will gain some insights, and it will prove to be helpful in their own use of technology in education.
It definitely will. And I just want to conclude then, in terms of this interview, that I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this finishes our exclusive interview with Sir John Daniel, President and Chief Executive Officer, Commonwealth of Learning.